I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
Well, I got a really special guest here today. Manon Delude is an individual who has two different extremely important distinctions that she's really mastered, one around coaching and one around being a psychotherapist. She's got a PhD in coaching and in human development and also a registered psychotherapist and has done those two different types of practices for several years and often will take on coaching clients in her day, but also therapy clients in her day. And Manon, just welcome to the Business of Intuition. And maybe if we could start, would you give us a definition as to what constitutes a coach versus a therapist? How are they different? How are they similar?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I'm really excited and having this conversation with you. This is a big question you're asking. I would say that, well, first of all, there's a big distinction in education and the process that somebody goes through to be a mental health professional, whether it be a psychotherapist or a psychologist. So the level of education is different. It's much more extensive than the world of coaching. Although some master coaches and coaches who have coached for a long time have gone through their own journey of learning and development. So I don't want to minimize that. However, I think that one of the things that would distinguish what I do as a therapist versus what I do as a coach is when I work as a therapist is I really work with getting my clients to recover psychologically from a state of mind that is painful, that is usually prompted by whether it is a very painful transition in life or a loss or something has triggered them to spiral down psychologically. And at that point, they're just not functioning optimally. There's a difference when we work as coaches. As coaches, we want people or we imagine our clients to be well, to be functioning, to be prepared to take on new challenges. And actually, you and I in the past have talked about this, that part of my postdoctorate interest was to differentiate a client who is a therapy client versus a coaching client. And the reason why I got turned on to this idea is when I was doing my doctorate research, I actually had all my participants of my research or those who wanted to participate in my research project, I had them complete a brief symptom inventory. So I was basically measuring their psychological wellness before I started doing coaching with them. And I had determined that there was a specific point at which the client would be considered to be psychologically, clinically unwell. So I had put that as my threshold, that if someone, a participant for my research, showed up, completed the assessment, and scored at that level or above, that they would be excluded. To my great surprise, we ended up excluding 24% of the people who were really excited about getting coaching and using coaching as a way to move forward life. We just felt that at that point, they were not going to be successful. Their psychological distress was too high. So what the coach does is the coach works with the client now in the present, looking at what's happening now in their life and where they want to go in the future. And we often come with the assumption that the client is vibrant, healthy, resourceful, and full of energy and capable to take on these challenges. The mental health professional, the psychotherapist that I am, I come from the perspective that I am here to help people recover of whatever is weighing them down. And it has much more of a medical aspect to it. I will assess things like the quality of their sleep and the quality of their thoughts and the quality of the emotions they live with every day. And I will work closely with physicians, medical professionals to assist them in their recovery. So the work is different. I always will say coaching picks up where therapy ends, because once a client has done their good therapy work and they've recovered, now they're ready for coaching.
So you'd mentioned 23-24% of your study indicated that those that wanted coaching really weren't ready for it because they still had some, in a sense, therapy that needed to happen. Has that been expanded? I know without science behind it, do you find in your experience that your coachees or those who want to be coached, an equal percentage probably just aren't ready?
The one thing I'm going to say to you is, you know, if you look at the statistics, both in Canada and the US, the statistics are clear that 25% of all individuals, 25% will experience one episode of mental health struggles in their lifetime. So my study was very much aligned with what the overall statistics are. So it was another way of qualifying it. When people come to me, whether they're a therapy client or a coaching client, they want to make their life better. That's part of the human spirit. We want to get better. And we know when things are not at their best. The challenge is that the client doesn't always know what they need. They know they need something. It's like when I take my car to the car dealership and I go, it's not working right. And I use my very lay language to tell them that it's ticking the wrong way or humming the wrong way. And the expert takes the time to assess the car and goes, oh, you just need a small tune-up, or, oh my God, your engine really needs a lot of cleanup. Well, when people come to me, that's a bit like that. They come to me, they know they need a change. They know it's not working in their life, but they don't know how to go about it. They don't have the tools. And so as a professional with the dual role, I have more ability to assess, are we needing a big engine tune-up or just an oil change? I'm not sure I answered your question.
No, you did. And I'm now curious as to, do you go through an assessment process and do you tell people, I think you need therapy or I think you need coaching? Do you have that kind of conversation with your clients?
When they come for therapy, they're clear they want therapy. But when a client comes for coaching, I will take the time to ask very pointed questions around not just their life satisfaction, around work and life in general. I will go as deep as asking about the quality of their sleep. Do they sleep well? Can they fall asleep? Can they stay asleep? When they wake up, do they feel rested? I will ask questions around their level of energy, their level of motivation. Do they feel motivated, or is motivation an ongoing struggle? Because anybody who has an ongoing struggle with motivation, with energy, with desire to get things going, concentration is a great factor that we need to be paying attention to. People who will report poor sleep, poor motivation, poor energy, poor concentration. When I start hearing those things, they're really big red flags. And that's when I start saying to the client, you know what? I want to ask you more questions. And if you give me permission. And so then I will ask much more questions about their psychological health, what a typical day looks like. I ask about whether they worry and what kind of worrying do they have and how much that worry has a grasp on them. You know, you and I might just kind of have I wonder what will happen a week or two from now. We may have something that's kind of putting us on our growing edge and we get little butterflies about that and we may be nervous. People will often use the word worrying for that. But when I talk about worry, I talk about anxious thinking. When people start thinking that they may lose control of their life, that their life may unravel, that if one thing goes bad, it will provoke a chain reaction of 10 more things to go bad. And then all of a sudden, they imagine their life just absolutely in shambles and ruined. And it's hard for people to imagine that when they're well, that their brain may make them think that way. They don't choose to think that way.
Would you then after you've had these questions answered, have you had situations coming to you, Manon, I want you to be my coach. You ask some questions and you go, I think this person actually needs therapy at this point. Would you make that recommendation at that point?
Absolutely.
Got it. Absolutely. Well, I think what's so fascinating about your abilities is that you hit the whole continuum. Whereas a lot of coaches that I know might not realize that the person that they are struggling to coach actually shouldn't have a coach. They should have a therapist, and the coach overdoes the work. They try to do things that they're not skilled at doing, or don't even have the idea that what they're trying to do is not going to be successful because they're applying the wrong tool. I just think it's fascinating that you have this one, you have the continuum of skills, but you also have the ability to determine what that person needs, which makes you so unique in your practice. It's fantastic. When it comes to this topic of people tapping into trusting and having the courage to use their intuition, which in my kind of definition also takes on the idea of that true authentic individual who is able to have the amount of self-awareness that they can get a little bit out of their head and into their heart. They can be a pattern recognizer and be guided by a voice that they may not necessarily understand, but there's something that's driving them toward a decision or an impression. When it comes to intuition, where does it show up in your practice? Do you see it? Do you encourage it? I'm just wondering if it fits or if it doesn't fit.
Well, I think that it fits in many ways. And I'm just going to open up a little parenthesis here, if you give me permission.
Sure.
I was doing some reading and reminding myself, one of the very interesting factor is that we actually have cells in our stomach that create and produce serotonin. And serotonin is the neurotransmitter that we have in our brain that makes us feel good. So often the stomach, the gut, is considered to be our second brain. So when you say to people, what's your gut telling you? It's actually quite important. And whether you call it your gut feeling or your intuition, it's really important to pay attention to what it feels like inside of you. Does it feel right? You know, there are situations you get into and you kind of go, it didn't feel quite right, but I kind of went along with it because I justified myself. And in the end, you end up being validated one way or another that the situation was just not right. So I think as a therapist, so I'll answer in twofold. So as a therapist, I think that a lot of the time when people come to me and they are struggling, let's say, and what I see the most is people who struggle with depression and anxiety. And most of my clients are high functioning, they're working, they're still involved in the workplace, but their psychological resilience is not at its best. And when you have people in that state of mind, they sometimes lose trust in their intuition because they know that they're not at their best. And with depression and anxiety comes a sense of confusion, a sense that life isn't, people just feel like their connection to life is not vibrant, it's not healthy. And so not only do they lose a sense of connection to their ability to think and problem solve effectively, they also lose a connection to their intuition. I see more connection to intuition in my coaching clients because they can tap into that multi-level inner resources, I can say. I use it more, I would say, when I work with my clients. I also ask, I think that all coaches who have my background, who also are mental health practitioners, would say that when they work with a coaching client and that client is truly a coaching client, you see that the client is resourceful and the answers just come to them. And that's the magic of coaching. The magic of coaching is you know the answer.
Do you find with people who are your therapy clients that although they're struggling with something psychological, that their particular process for healing involves trusting that intuitive gut that might not be fully operational, but when they are healthy, it is, and that by getting them back to that intuitive gut, it feels somewhat like home. Like, okay, that feels something like what I used to feel like when I was well. Do you help guide people back to their gut, to their intuition, even if they're therapy clients, because that's what they do to process themselves out of these emotional traumas?
So I think that what I would do is I would guide them back to what I know makes them work well. So I bring them back to the physical. So it's not quite bringing them back to their gut yet, but it's bringing them back to physicality. When you bring the body back into action, see, when you struggle emotionally, often what happens is people stop wanting to move. And when people start moving again, so whether they decide that they're going to go for walks or they're going to go for a bike ride or they're going to go hiking, there's a reconnection to physicality, a reconnection to self. And when you exercise, you feed your brain. When you exercise, you start building and creating more serotonin. So it kickstarts the brain, it kickstarts the body. And then the more people get connected to their body and to their physical well-being, then they get reconnected to their intuition. So intuition is in the body, and we need to reconnect with the body.
So, Menon, you've given us a great background into your practice and your science behind it. Do you have a story, a reference, a memory of when you may have made an intuitive gut decision that necessarily wasn't based on a lot of facts and information that had a profound effect on the direction of your life?
Oh, my. You're asking me that.
That was an unprepared question, I realize.
Prepared question, and now you're asking me to go through your
lexicon
life.
Of memory, right? If something pops up, if it doesn't pop up, I understand. But if something like, oh yeah, when I made this decision, didn't make any sense at the time, but boy, did it have a profound effect on where I was going, and I'm glad I did that. Anything show up for you around that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this. I was working in a clinic, and it just wasn't working well for me. I'm probably a free spirit, and I like to work in a very autonomous way. So at one point, there came a time when I was at a crossroad. Either I was going to look for work in another clinic, or I was going to work in private practice. And in that moment, I told myself, I need to fly solo. And it just was this feeling that as long as I worked in settings that were, you know, full of governmental rules. And it's not that I'm not working with rules, because as a psychotherapist, I work with all kinds of rules and ethics. But, you know, there were parameters that I wouldn't have to face in private practice. And the day I decided to go into private practice, I called all of my friends, all of my colleagues, and I told them that I was flying solo and that I needed their support. And I think that what I was not prepared for was the amount of support I received. So my gut was telling me I needed to follow the path, and I did it bravely, because it was scary to think that I would generate my own income. But that's well over 22 years ago. And I've never looked back. And it's not to say that I've been doing the same thing, because in the last 22 years, oh God, I have done so many different interesting projects, both as a coach and as a psychotherapist. But I would say that that was a time where I had to decide for myself what was right and really listen. I think that would be one of my examples.
Great. I get that. And I think that in our conversations, we've met a few times during conferences, I've shared with you some of my decisions that have changed the course of my life, which made no sense at the time. Like starting a practice, like you said, it was by some a foolhardy thing to do, but it turned out to work out very, very well. And my gut feeling was what kind of guided me there. And then over years, I've begun to really trust that some more. I guess my other question is, do you find that when you're coaching or using your skills as a psychotherapist, that part of your tool set in helping that individual get to source, get to the truth, or get to something that is a blind spot for them, that you use your own intuition to help uncover that through the kinds of questions you may ask or kinds of statements you might provide.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you work, and likely you've experienced that as well, you know, when I work with a client, I am listening to their answers, but I'm watching everything. I'm watching the way they move. I watch the way they sit. I watch the color of their skin and how the color of their skin may change as emotions fluctuate inside of them. So I watch them, and I also watch myself. I watch what I experience in my body. I watch what I experience in my being. And sometimes I'll say to them, I don't know what's going on here. Help me understand, but I can't help but feel like there's tension around this. At times I've even felt sick. And I might say, I don't know why, but I'm having a hard time breathing. Or I'm having a hard time, I'm feeling nauseous right now. What's going on for you? Is something wrong? And so, you know, sometimes they'll go, no, I'm okay. And then I'll just dismiss it and say, oh, okay, probably was just a moment in my body. But at times they'll come back and they'll say, you know, when you said that, this is what was going on for me, but I didn't identify it. I wasn't ready to speak about it. So I think that as coaches, we pick up on things that are intangible all the time. And we need to pay attention to that. Otherwise, we work with our head, and that's just one dimension.
This is awesome. So the question that I now am trying to formulate is, what's the difference, if any, between intuition and empathy?
Ah, okay.
And is there one? Because you're saying that you are tapping into how you're experiencing yourself around another person.
Yes.
You know, so you're tuning into them, you're doing pattern recognition, all the things that your conscious and unconscious mind might be doing that you may not even have language for. But then all of a sudden you start feeling something in your own body that might give you an indication of what's going on with them. The question that I'm trying to unpack here is, are we intuitive there, or are they stimulating something in us that has nothing to do with them?
Okay, so this is a multi-level question. Let me see if I can unpack that. I think that the difference between intuition and empathy is, when I have empathy, I'm strictly focused on how the person in front of me is feeling, and I am not feeling what they feel, but I am referring to my own life experience, my own experience with emotions. And so, for example, let's imagine that someone is grieving the loss of a child. I have never had this experience, but I have experienced grief. I've experienced deep sadness in my life. And so I will sit with them in deep appreciation for the level of their pain and use my frame of reference. My pain is not their pain, and I don't feel their pain, but I have an appreciation for where they're at and their struggle. And that's how I would describe empathy. Empathy is about appreciating, valuing the emotion the other person in front of you is facing and feeling, and treating that with a lot of respect and compassion. Intuition is what happens inside of me. Now, I will take a step back and say, you know, sometimes people can't name their emotions, but I have witnessed these emotions so many times in other people that I can help them name it. That is still empathy, because I recognize what they are experiencing. Intuition is what I feel. It's my gut feeling. It's my experience. And you're very right, Dean, that at times what we experience may be an intuition. It might just be a sense that we're touching something that has not been spoken of yet, or may be spoken of, but you're also differentiating it with somebody being triggered. So intuition and being triggered is two different things. So an emotional trigger would be, somebody says something and it reminds me of my own past. a past relationship, a past moment, likely a moment or a relationship where there is some level of unfinished business. And then it triggers an old emotion of mine. And that is very different than intuition. Because that moment, when I'm triggered, I'm myself emotionally hijacked.
So I've run into this. I'm sure any coach and therapist has run into this at different times. But I'm curious, from your perspective, how do you stay focused on the client even though your bells just got rung? How do you blot that out? How do you say, take a back seat. This is not about you right now. I got this client here paying me X number of dollars an hour. It's about them. I mean, what goes through your head, your heart, that tunes out your stuff that could get in the way of your ability to find truth in the client?
So there's a term for this. What you're describing is called countertransference. In the world of therapy, therapists spend hours in supervision conversation about how they have countertransference toward clients. And countertransference doesn't have to be negative. It might just be that you really, 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 really like a client and you want so much more for them than they want for themselves. And you work harder than they work. And that would be a countertransference. You might say, you know, this person just reminds me of my dear cousin or my sister, and I love them so much. And so how we get connected with our clients, it's really important that we become aware of these little strings and how they're being pulled. So as a therapist and as a coach, when I sit with a client, well, this is about developing our emotional intelligence. It is about managing ourselves while we manage others. We ask that of leaders. We ask that leaders remain mindful of what they feel, what they think, what they feel in their body, that they regulate it, that they don't let their brain take over or that their mouth doesn't take over, and that they regulate their emotions. We ask that of executives that we coach and of individuals we coach. Well, it's the same for therapists and for coaches. We have to be mindful of what we live, the emotions we experience. If we are well versed and well trained in having these conversations with ourselves and the self-awareness, we can identify it and then say, that's about me and I need to park it. And then we need to find ourselves, whether it's a colleague, whether it's a supervisor, whether it's a therapy supervisor or a coaching supervisor, because there is such a thing as coaching supervision, we need to go and unpack it so that it doesn't stay in the way. Because if we don't understand it and we don't diffuse it, then that emotion and that thinking pattern could keep repeating itself in future meetings with that client. And then it interferes with our effectiveness.
So I suppose that the severity of a person's situation that you're coaching or providing therapy to could make one more prone to experience this countertransference that you're talking about. Because we are human beings and we do feel and we see people suffer, sometimes it's hard not to evoke our own suffering, that it doesn't get re-stimulated because we see it elsewhere. I know that you've told me some stories about you getting involved in situations where you provided therapy after huge tragedies, 9/11, for example, down plane crashes and so forth. Can you give kind of a brief overview for people who don't know that about you? What sort of happened? And how did you keep yourself from this countertransference that you just described?
Yes. So probably the most powerful story was when I worked with the Canadian Coast Guard when Swiss Air went down. And it's quite a while back now, actually. It was in September 1998. And I had been already 3 weeks at Peggy's Cove, where the Coast Guard had one of its operation center. So every day I was hearing about the various debris that the Canadian Coast Guard staff were salvaging out of the ocean. And realistically, I was prepared for that and I was grounded And although it was extraordinary situations for them, and even for myself as a therapist, we were putting perspective on the importance and the value of the work that we were doing. We were all telling ourselves that this work was done both to honor the victim of the crash as well as to honor the surviving family members. And we were doing this very hard work on their behalf, and it really sustained us. However, just on the very, very tail end of my assignment there, I was just about to go home, and I sat with an individual who told me the story of how someone close to them on the night of the crash had jumped into their boat because they were living by the ocean and had gone out to sea and had wanted to help. And this individual was saying, you know, my loved one went to sea, hoping and praying that whatever they would encounter, they could deal with. Because at that point, they didn't know it was a plane crash. It was literally minutes after. And unfortunately, this individual got to pick up out of the ocean the body of a child. And what triggered me about this was the following part of the story, when the person who was telling me the story, and they needed help to reconcile this whole experience, was that the individual in the boat had treated this child with all the respect, love, and compassion that it needed, and guarded and protected this child's body and made it his responsibility to protect the child while there were no loved ones, no parents to take care of this child. So here's the countertransference. The countertransference for me was that somewhere in my past, at one point, I had my own childhood wounds, and that at one point, for some reason, I had not felt cherished and valued. And this story really triggered me. And it triggered me because I thought, oh my God, this individual treated this child that he did not know like it was a treasure. And it triggered me because it reminded me of times when I was not treasured, but it also inspired me. So it became a countertransference. It really rocked my world. I had to do a lot of work around it. But in the end, the life lesson out of this countertransference was that every child is a child of the universe, and that we are all responsible to take care of each other. And that I am valuable, and that you are valuable, and everybody's valuable, because we all belong to the universe, and the universe is our parent. And when I phrase it that way, for me, it changes the way I look at life, the way I look at people, but it also helped me value me. So out of a situation where somebody's story and their hurt came and triggered my hurt, I had to do my own healing and listening to what was happening. Why was I so triggered? I became very sad. I became very upset. It took me days and days to unpack and unravel that experience, to connect with this very precious part of me. And so it's also something that I use every day in my work now, that when I have someone in front of me, I know that they're a child of the universe. I know the universe is protecting them. I know that I don't have to do all the work to make them feel good, that they are responsible to make themselves feel good, to find their journey, and that I'm walking the journey with them. But the responsibility doesn't all belong to me. So countertransference is a very powerful experience for therapists and for coaches. And it's not something we speak a lot about in the world of coaching. So small counter transference could be when a client just gets under your nerves and you just don't know why, but they are just annoying you. And session after session, you don't feel you click with them. Well, if you took the time to unpack your counter transference, you likely would find that connecting link. But going back to my experience of Swissair, I would say that was not only a transformative experience for those who lost loved ones, it was a transformative experience for many of us who worked on this event. We all left transformed.
Menon, thanks for that story and your insights. I think they've just been absolutely fascinating. You brought a level of sensitivity and knowledge to this topic that I think is really valuable. And it's just got me thinking in so many different directions here, especially when it comes to the coach or the therapist to get out of their own way to be of service to another. And it's hard to do that often because we are human beings as well. We're also going through our own transformation and our own development. And the very process we want others to go through, we have to go through as well. So is there any kind of final thoughts, anything that we should be looking for you in the future? I know you've done some posts with videos and any more of that coming up, any way that the rest of us can kind of connect and keep in touch with the kinds of work that you're doing?
Well, I continue to put videos on YouTube. So go to my YouTube channel, Menon Dulude. And, you know, certainly I hope that you and I will have a chance to chat again. I think that the direction I'm going into now is looking at extreme self-care for coaches, for therapists, so that they can show up at their best. So I think that in the next little while, you'll be hearing more about me, about extreme self-care and what that means.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.